So I spent a fair bit of time on regular QCD, but today we're going to essentially scale this story up and use it for electroweak symmetry breaking. So what we've done with QCD is we know that at high energies we have quark and gluon degrees of freedom, and a corresponding coupling strength that depends on essentially the energy scale at which you measure it. And as you extrapolate the scale down from high energies, it starts off small at high energies, and you extrapolate it down, and you find that at some point the coupling blows up. This means your whole perturbation theory toolkit breaks down, and you have to find other ways to compute in the theory instead of just usual perturbation theory and Feynman diagrams and so on. And looking at the structure of QCD, or at least the low energy states in QCD, we concentrated on the case of pure QCD with only up and down quarks. And we use the fact that m up, m down is much less than lambda QCD. And the fact that in the limit that these masses go to zero, we have a global we have a global symmetry group. And with with this feature, plus the fact that we have this quark condensate, we find that this global symmetry group is spontaneously broken. And we can write down a theory for the Goldstone bosons in the limit that m up and down go to zero. That's what we did. We got a theory for three pions, which we can identify with the neutral and charged pions. And then after deriving the theory for these would-be massless Goldstones, we can put the masses back in. And this gives us mass terms for the pions. By matching currents in the underlying quark theory and gluon theory coupled to the weak force, we can match up currents and use that to extrapolate to figure out what some of the parameters are in our in our low energy effective theory. We wrote the low energy effective theory in terms of these so-called sigma fields, which recall is just exponential 2i pi a of x ta over f. And the motivation for this form comes from the general structure of Goldstone bosons, in that it's often convenient to write Goldstone bosons in a form that looks like a transformation acting on the vacuum state. In this case, the vacuum state in this sort of left-right basis looked like the identity. And this looks like essentially a general SU2 left or SU2 right transformation of this vacuum state. And we found that these fields under the unbroken so-called SU2 V subgroup transformed in the adjoint, whereas under the set of broken generators, they transform by a shift. So in this case, we still have the underlying symmetry, but we're realizing the symmetry in a nonlinear way. And this is, again, a standard feature of Goldstone bosons. Now, in any case, we wrote down a general Lagrangian such that we got reasonable kinetic terms. And we maintained a symmetry, an invariance under these transformations. And this effective field theory is non-normalizable. It ends up being a set of powers of derivatives of pi over f. And at the end of the day, in this effective theory, because we can't match perturbatively with QCD, we either have to match through non-perturbative methods like lattice QCD or by matching the data. In any case, we have a nice effective theory that describes low-energy QCD, or at least part of low-energy QCD containing the Goldstone part of the story. Now, in principle, you can extend this SU2 U1 structure to an SU3 U1 if you include the strange quark. And in the case of the strange quark, your Goldstone approximation is no longer as good. It's broken in a worse way because MS is roughly similar to lambda QCD, but you can still go through, do the same thing, and get a spectrum of more complicated pions, or sorry, I shouldn't say pions, but mesons. In this case, you'll get an adjoint worth, so you'll get 8 of them. And essentially, you can repeat this. You'll find larger masses, larger breaking, but you still get a pretty good description of the pions. It's just that in this case, you can extend the mass corrections to leading order, whereas with a strange quark, you have to go to higher order typically. In any case, this is QCD. And I should also add that these are not the only states you get in low energy QCD. So this is only a low energy effective theory for the very light states, the would-be Goldstones. In this case, the pions, the lightest states. But in principle, there are also lots of other QCD bound states. There are some scalar bound states. There are some vector bound states. The vector bound states actually end up being very, very important. And again, these are all meson bound states. And you also have baryon bound states. And baryon bound states are not included at all within this description. Neither are these other states. But again, part of the problem is that we don't have perturbative control over the theory. So we're just doing what we can. But in principle, there are other states that are not easy to describe, or they're not described in this language, and they're not easy to describe in an effective theory anyhow, just because we don't have as much symmetry control. Yeah.
Just for speculative reasons, there are two ways, right? So on effective theory, vector bound state, then we would expect our vacuum to have some index, right? Some group or something like that, or that?
Well, for a vector bound state, you'd write a Lagrangian and just put in a vector field, and you'd write down all the couplings of that vector consistent with the symmetries, and just fix them with data. And the point is that that's about all you can do. But the challenge, though, from the start, is because this is a strongly coupled transition, we were able to figure out that we should have 3 Goldstone modes based on the symmetries, but we don't have any method in general for the strongly coupled transition to know what the other degrees of freedom are. So this is, if you like, a more extreme case of matching effective field theories where we don't even necessarily know what the low energy degrees of freedom are. And a lot of them you have to just get from data. So you find various hadronic resonances and then you write them into your effective Lagrangian. It's only really these pion states that we can say in some sense for sure that they should be there. Okay, so in any case, this is what we did for QCD, and we looked at pure QCD with no reference or almost no reference to electromagnetism or the weak force. Now, in your tutorial yesterday, you looked at some aspects of electromagnetism, and I want to continue with that and look at QCD in conjunction with the weak force and then extend it to something called technicolor. So the first point is that if we only had QCD, if we only had QCD and the weak force and no Higgs, first of all, we wouldn't have any quark masses. And we wouldn't have the usual electric symmetry breaking. But it turns out that in that limit, in the limit of just standard model quarks plus weak force plus QCD, you would still get electric symmetry breaking from this quark condensate. So that's the thing I want to cover now. So electric symmetry break from QCD. And first of all, let's look at just a simplified standard model. So let's assume that the only fermions in a theory are one generation of Q, and then an upright downright. So I'll assume that these are my only fermions. So for now, I'll ignore all the leptons and all the other generations. And on top of that, I'll assume that I have no Higgs, but that I also have a full SU3 cross SU2L cross U1Y gauge invariants. So let's take the full gauge structure of the standard model, but let's pretend there's no Higgs at all. And let's just keep one generation of quarks and only that part. And if we were to write down a theory for this. Well, we'd have these quarks, and we'd write down a covariant derivative for them. And we'd have the gauge terms for the SU3, SU2, U1. And first of all, within this theory, you wouldn't have any quark mass terms at all. And this will change the running of the strong coupling. But let's assume that the strong coupling still runs strong at about the same point. Now, we want to write a Lagrangian for the quarks that's fully invariant. So of course we need kinetic terms. So of course we have our usual and I'm going to suggestively write the up and down quarks also as a doublet. So this is close to the whole story. And the only thing we have to put in is this covariant derivative. And this covariant derivative is just the usual kinetic term plus IG. Plus IG acting with IG3, G mu R TR SU3. Plus G2 W mu A, in this case TA2, plus IG prime, and the hypercharge of this is 1/6 B mu. So this is our full covariant derivative for this D mu field. And the D mu here is a little bit different. The D mu here is still going to be d mu plus I gs 2, 3, r g mu r. And now there's no SU2 piece because even though I'm writing this as a doublet, it doesn't have any SU2 charge, but it does have a hypercharge. And the hypercharge is 2/3. G prime, E mu. So the left and right-handed pieces now have slightly different gauge covariant derivatives. But again, this is just like the usual standard model piece. Oh, sorry. The 2/3 isn't quite right. So the 2/3 So this is a slight cheat. So these PLPRs are not these PLPRs are not the usual left and right projectors. They're projectors on the up and down parts of the Q-right doublet. So remember, Q-right is, I'm just writing this as upright, downright. And the point is that for upright, it has hypercharge 2/3, and for downright, it has hypercharge minus 1/3. And the p tilde here is acting in this flavor space, not in the not in the Dirac space. So in other words, this PL is just 1, 0, 0, 0, and the PR is 0, 0, 0, 1, acting in the flavor space. Okay, so this is slightly non-standard notation, but okay, in any case, we have this Lagrangian. And first of all, let's assume that the electroweak part. Let's assume first of all that the electroweak gauge couplings go to zero. So if the electroweak gauge couplings were zero, I wouldn't have this term, and I wouldn't have this term, and I wouldn't have this term, and I wouldn't have that term. And in this case, I would have a full SU2 left cross SU2R cross U1V symmetry. Now the fact that I have non-zero couplings here means that means that I no longer preserve that full symmetry. I actually have an explicit breaking. And the explicit breaking, we're not going to worry too much about it. We're going to treat it a bit like you treated electromagnetism in the, we're going to treat it a little bit like we treated electromagnetism in the case of, like you did in the tutorial. But what these things break specifically is the SU2R global invariance we had, we would have were they non-zero. Because we're treating, this part is fine, this part's not fine. Because here I'm treating the up and down parts of the doublet differently. So actually, now, one more thing I have is in my initial discussion of QCD, I treated SU2 left and SU2 right and U1V as global symmetries. Now, when I put in the, these weak gauge couplings, I now have I still have a full SU2 left, and I still have SU3 color, but I've explicitly broken SU2 right. I still preserve the U1V. But one other thing I get is what I've done effectively by putting in this covariant derivative term is I've effectively gauged the SU2 left global symmetry. So this theory has a global SU2 left, but I've also gauged it by coupling to the vector boson, which means that this theory has both a global and a local invariant under SU2 left transformations. It's the same group, but on the one hand I have global transformations, and the other I have local. So in any case, here's my simplified standard model. And one thing you can see immediately, assuming that my lambda QCD or my alpha QCD runs large, is that how do I want to write this? Q bar I, QL. One thing I can see immediately is that this delta ij lambda QCD cubed quark condensate spontaneously breaks my SU2 left. On top of that, we can try to identify, we can also identify the hypercharged part of the standard model gauge transformations with a subgroup of this combination. So with a bit of fiddling, you can show that the hypercharge corresponds to T3 right plus 2/3. Oops. So with a bit of fiddling, you can show the hypercharge corresponds to 1/6. The 1/6 acting on the left-handed piece is just 1/6, and T3 right acting on the left-handed piece is 0. On the other hand, for T3 right, here I have hypercharged 2/3, which is 1/2, which is the upper part of T3 right. So this corresponds to the upper component acting on U right. And 2/3 is conveniently 1/2 plus 1/6. And this is acting on the down part. And the lower part has T3 right of minus 1/2. Minus 1/2 plus 1/6 gives me minus 1/3. So in this sense, I can identify this combination of generators with hypercharge. And recall that a general, okay. So I have this. And then I can also identify the electromagnetic coupling with T3L plus T3R plus so I can also identify a subgroup of this global group with electromagnetism. So going back to my global flavor symmetries, some of which are preserved and some of which are broken, and my gauge symmetries, I have a theory that would have this full flavor symmetry group in the absence of electroweak gauge couplings. Now I've put in electroweak gauge couplings, and that means that some fraction of this global symmetry group is explicitly broken, but I still preserve a subgroup. And the subgroup that I do preserve at this level is the full SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. So the SU3 is explicit. The SU2 is fairly explicit in that it only applies to this, and this explicitly preserves it. And if I look at hypercharge Y, the hypercharge Y is an unbroken subgroup, or is a subgroup of this full structure that's not broken by the gauge couplings. So the point is, we have some gauge subgroup of this full would-be flavor symmetry group. And when we turn on, or when the quark condensate turns on, we see that some fraction of this gauge symmetry is going to be spontaneously broken. So just as an aside, remember that under these transformations, under a general SU2 left cross SU2 right cross U1 transformation, this goes to e to the I alpha A left TA e to the I alpha V QL, and QR goes to e to the I alpha right So when I write this kind of generator, this means that I set the coefficient for the alpha 3 part of the right part to be the same as alpha v over 6. So in other words, a Y transformation on Q right would be e to the I alpha T3 right e to the I alpha over 6. So you should read this as a shorthand for this transformation. It's a subset of these transformations. Okay, so we have this structure, and it's obvious that some fraction of, well, first of all, the would-be global group in the absence of gauge couplings is spontaneously broken. This is what we saw before. We saw that in QCD, SC2 left cross SC2 right cross U1V is broken down to SC2V cross U1V spontaneously. Now, in this case, we don't have this full symmetry. So a smaller subset of this will be explicitly broken. But on top of that, on top of that, some fraction of this is gauged. Because some fraction of this is gauged, the Goldstone boson story is going to be a bit different. So it turns out that instead of having the full SU2V, the subgroup of this part that is the subgroup of this thing that is not explicitly broken by the gauge couplings is the U1Y subgroup that's a linear combination of part of the SU2 right and part of the U1V. So I can choose a different basis in which I write an invariant under U1Y and U1. So this is obviously U1Y invariant, but it's not SU2 right invariant. The other thing is that the subgroup of this that is unbroken turns out to be U1 electromagnetism cross U1V. So as far as U1V goes, if you change the normalization, you can show that the U1V actually corresponds to baryon number. So we know that in the standard model, baryon number is conserved, and it just corresponds identically to the U1V up to a normalization. Okay, so we have spontaneous breaking, and the pattern of spontaneous breaking is just like the pattern of spontaneous breaking that we get from the Higgs. And if we count the number of degrees of freedom, or the number of generators, here we have 3 explicit generators, and here we have 1 and 1. And we're left with 1 and 1. So So we would have three nimble Goldstone bosons, but we've gauged. We've gauged a chunk of the symmetry. And if we look at the number of gauge generators that are broken, we started with, in this case, three gauge generators and one gauge generator, and we're left with one gauge generator. And that means that we've gone from three gauge generators to one gauge generator, which means that all three number Goldstone bosons will be eaten. So in principle, you could have a larger breaking of the global symmetry than the gauge symmetry, in which case you'll have some Goldstone modes left over. But in this case, they match up 1-to-1. So let me go back over here. Okay, now we can see this story explicitly. And to see this story explicitly, we can go back and copy what we did with QCD to try to write down an effective Lagrangian for the would-be Goldstone modes below lambda QCD, but now upgrading our regular derivatives to covariant derivatives. And our regular derivatives to covariant derivatives should also reflect the fact that we have a larger global symmetry in the limit that some of the gauge couplings go to zero. So it turns out that the way to do this is very analogous to what you looked at is completely analogous to what you did for electromagnetism. And what you do is you just take the chiral Lagrangian we had before, take the leading term, and you change the regular derivatives to covariant derivatives. And the way to do this So this comes about because, as far as these fields go, the U1V piece just cancels through. We know that SU2 left is gauged and it should actually be a good symmetry. And if you look at the infinitesimal transformation under SU2 left, it's just sigma goes to alpha A, TA, sigma. And under right transformations, I would have sigma goes to sigma TA. But now, because I want to concentrate on hypercharge, the hypercharge piece is the T3 part only. So under infinitesimal hypercharge transformations, the one piece just cancels through on the sigma, and I'm left with the T3 part acting from the right. And that gives me the minus sign and the T3. So this is my covariant derivative in terms of this chiral Lagrangian. And just like you do for the Higgs, recall that when you have spontaneous breaking initiated through a Higgs boson, you find the vector boson masses by taking the Higgs kinetic term with covariant derivatives and expanding it out. And that's where the vector masses come from. And if you do the same thing here with my sigma field also reflects that I have a non-zero condensate built in. Yes?
So on the sigma, the U1 that the gauge by a joint action, right? So that's what we saw yesterday.
Yeah, so suppose I had the full SU2 left. So if I had the full SU2 left, SU2 right, and then on top of this, I would also have the U1V part acts trivially in the sense that I would also have e to the I alpha . But the whole point is that these things commute through and just cancel. And the same thing happens on the vacuum. So if I act with this on the vacuum Q bar I, QL, doesn't care about the U1V transformations. And the upshot of that is the upshot of that is everything just transfers through.
What I'm trying to kind of get at is this: in yesterday's tutorial, when we gave you the command of the co-grand derivative that we got had a commutator. So
it's slightly different from
because sigma is where the matrix value is.
The commutator applies when you expand out the sigma to write it in terms of in terms of the pi's. So here I'm just writing it at the level of sigmas, but you can also write it at the level of pi's. And it turns out that those two things are equivalent. Okay, so in any case, I have this transformation law and this covariant derivative. And if I expand out my Lagrangian, you can show that you get a bunch of pieces. So this is just a straightforward expansion. And if I keep the leading pieces, I get something that looks like, first of all, f over 2 g w mu plus del mu pi minus plus f over 2 d w minus w mu pi plus f over 2 g w mu 3 plus g prime b mu del mu pi 0. So if I expand out these covariant derivatives, this is the set of terms I get. And there are two classes of terms. The first class of terms involve the would-be pion fields. And the second class of terms are clearly bilinear in the vector fields. And these are clearly vector boson masses. So for these first pieces, the first pieces look a little bit funny. They have the form of bilinear connecting the vector to the derivative of one of the pion fields. So for example, if I drew this as the Feynman diagram, I would have a pion connecting to a W plus. And the same thing can happen with Higgs fields. And the reason why you usually don't see this is that in the examples you've probably done so far, with the Higgs field, you choose a nice gauge. And for the Higgs field, you choose a nice gauge such that you make the Higgs real, and then you expand around that. If you didn't choose that nice gauge, you would find that the imaginary part of the Higgs field would have couplings to the vector boson of this form. And the interpretation of this is that these bilinear couplings are a signal of the Goldstone modes. So the linear combinations of the fields in your theory that couple in this bilinear way to the vector bosons are what you identify as the Goldstone modes. And it turns out that in a sense these are gauge artifacts. That they don't contribute to physical processes if you treat them properly. So these terms should just be interpreted as pi plus minus pi zero are Eden Goldstones. So this is a nice result. This is telling us that in regular QCD, in the simplified standard model theory, we would have electroweak symmetry breaking. We see the electroweak symmetry breaking, and we can write down its effects in terms of the fleeting chiral Lagrangian. And we are able to identify the states that would have been massless Goldstones in the absence of gauging the symmetry now with Eden Goldstone modes. So the rule is you identify these gold stones, and then wherever you see them in Lagrangian from now on, you set them to zero. As far as the vector boson masses, these vector boson masses give me mw squared of f squared over 2 g squared. And this mass term gives me a mass matrix of the form f squared over 2 g squared g prime g g prime g prime squared, which if you look at the mass eigenvalues of this, or if you look at the determinant is 0, because the determinant is this times this minus that equal to 0. And that tells me that the mass eigenstates are 0. And what turns out to be g squared plus g prime squared over 2 f squared. So we identify this with the photon. And we identify this with the z. And we obviously identify this with the w plus minus. And these are, in fact, the same expressions for the vector boson masses you would get at tree level in a standard model. But now, instead of having the Higgs-Vev, I have this pion decay constant, this so-called F piece that we can extract from pion decay. So we see that in the absence of a Higgs in the standard model, we would have electric symmetry breaking. We have this nice pattern. And we've essentially just included the gauging of the electroweak subgroup to our previous QCD theory. This is great, but of course, this doesn't actually describe nature, because we measure the W and Z bosons to be near 100 GeV, whereas if we try to identify this with QCD, the F for QCD is about 100 MeV. So we would get weak vector bosons of the order of 30 MeV instead of 100 GeV. So this doesn't work in the standard model. The other thing is, in the simplified theory, we don't have any fermion mass terms. And the fermions we do see have masses. So those two things don't work. But still, this is a nice idea. It works very cleanly. And it also doesn't have a hierarchy problem, in the sense that my fundamental degrees of freedom going from high energy are these fermion quark fields, these fermionic quark fields and these vector fields. And if you compute quantum corrections to their mass terms, well, at this level, at the top, there are no mass terms. And the absence of mass terms is enforced by the symmetries of the theory. So there's no hierarchy problem. In this case, all of the masses are induced dynamically. And in fact, there's a nice connection. You can show that if I rewrite my free-free expression for the running of lambda QCD, you can show that lambda QCD is given by some input scale, lambda naught, e to the minus 2 pi over the beta function coefficient of QCD alpha s of lambda naught. So the point of this is, suppose I start with some input theory defined at a very high scale. So suppose my input theory corresponds to some input, let's say, at the Planck scale, where I identify lambda naught with the Planck scale. And I have some input input gauge coupling alpha s of lambda 0. Through the renormalization group running effects, I will get a dynamically generated lower scale, starting from this input scale that's exponentially suppressed relative to the input. And this means that it's completely natural to have very low lambda QCD scales relative to very large input scales because of this exponential relation. So there are no large special numbers in here. As long as this alpha s isn't too large at the input scale, I'll get a relatively low lambda QCD. And this is, in fact, what happens in the standard model. So this is a nice picture. There's no gauge hierarchy problem, but it doesn't agree with data. So we can go one step further than this and write down and take the structure, but just translate it into a new gauge field on top of the standard model gauge groups and call it Technicolor. So Technicolor is the idea of replacing the Higgs with a strong dynamics, which doesn't have a hierarchy problem, but just scaling up the Technicolor group to something of order 100 GeV instead of something on the order of 100 MeV. So this brings me to Technicolor. And I'm using the American spelling of Technicolor because it was come up with by Americans, so I'll stick to the brand name rather than the correct spelling of color. In any case, we have Technicolor. And the idea of Technicolor is just take this QCD structure and scale up. So a minimal example of Technicolor is extend the standard model gauge group with an SUNTC. So we have the usual standard model gauge groups. And we extend it by this new piece. And for this new group, we're going to add some new so-called techniquarks. And we're going to add them in the following form. Q left is U left D left. And Q right is U right D right. And I'm going to take their quantum numbers under this full group to be, I'm going to assume that these guys transform in the fundamental under SUN Technicolor. I'm going to take them to be a singlet representation under SU3 color. I'm going to take them to be a doublet under SU2 left. And under hypercharge, I'm going to give them hypercharge 0. And for the right guys, I'm also going to take them to be, in this case, I'm going to take them to each be a fundamental. They won't have any color charge. I'm going to take them to be singlets under SU2 left. And I'm going to give them hypercharges of plus or minus 1/2. So if I think about the electric charges of these states after electric symmetry breaking, here I have a doublet. So the electric charges will be plus or minus 1/2. And here I have a singlet, but with hypercharge plus or minus 1/2. So this gives me electric charges of plus or minus 1/2. So my theory is now this SUNTC plus these guys. And in principle, I could have one flavor, or I could have a bunch of flavors. So let's assume that we have NF flavors. So as long as the number of flavors isn't too large compared to the number of colors, this gauge group will be asymptotically free. And as I run it down in energy, it will give you a condensate in the same way that QCD does. And this condensate, if I think about flavor symmetries, will now, in this case, typically break this SU2 left and hopefully hypercharge. And this will reproduce the QCD structure. So we just essentially copy the whole structure, Q bar I, QL, sorry, Q bar R, QL I is equal to delta IJ. But now because this is a new group, it can have a different condensation scale. So we're going to call it lambda TC, in complete analogy with the QCD lambda, the QCD core condensation scale. But now we're going to want this to be much larger, so they get larger vector boson masses. So in the absence of gauge couplings, we would have the following global symmetries: SU2NF L cross SU2NF R cross U1 V. And a subgroup of this will be SU2 left cross U1 Y. And we're going to gauge the subgroup just like we gauged, if you like, a subgroup of the SU2 left, SU2 right structure of in our toy standard model with no Higgs. So we have this big global symmetry group. We have a gauged subgroup. And now if we do the counting, this techniquark condensate is going to break this left-right 2NF cross 2NF structure cross, oh sorry, this is a hypercharge, this should be V. It's going to break this global symmetry structure down to it's going to break the global symmetry structure down to a subgroup. And that subgroup is going to be the vector subgroup of this. So if you count, here we initially have 2nf squared minus 1 here, 2nf squared minus 1, and here I have one generator. So this is the number of generators I have initially. And after the breaking, these will combine to give me the 2nf squared minus 1 unbroken generators for the vector subgroup plus these things. Now, if I do the counting, that means that I have 2nf squared minus 1 broken generators. And if I look at the structure, if I look at the subgroup that's gauged of this, it turns out that the gauge subgroup of this to the quark condensate is also broken down to U1 of electromagnetism. And then that means that I have 3 broken gauge generators. And that means that at the end, I'm going to get 3 massive vectors, the W and Z, W plus and minus and Z. And I'm going to have 2nf squared minus 4 NGBs. And we call these 2nf minus 4 NGBs technipions. And we call these guys at the start techniquarks for obvious reasons. Okay, so in exactly the same way as before, we can build, we can compute the masses of the vector bosons. In this case, we have a slightly more complicated multi-flavor covariant derivative structure. In the limit where I have 2 flavors, you reproduce the structure I have before. With nf flavors, it turns out that you get a slightly more complicated thing. You get mw squared being g squared over 2, nf ftc, and mz squared be g squared plus g prime squared over 2 nf ftc squared, where we expect, in analogy with QCD, that ftc is roughly lambda tc. So this is all very nice. And because we know the masses of the W and Z vector bosons, this lets us fix ftc. And it implies that ftc is roughly a few hundred GeV. So this is the idea of technicolor. You just take this QCD electroweak symmetry breaking structure, you scale it up to some new group. There are different realizations with different technicolor representations, but this is a minimal one. And this is what you get out. You get electroweak symmetry breaking. And in fact, the ratio of the W and Z masses work out right. But there's still problems with this. So I'm going to list 4 problems, and I'll talk about how they can be addressed. All your standard model fermions are still massless, just like in our QCD theory. So that's obviously a problem. We have massless technipion modes. for NF greater than 1. So recall that not all of these not all of the would-be Nyman-Goldstone boson modes are eaten by the vector bosons for NF greater than 1. Third, I haven't mentioned this explicitly, but there's a remaining So it turns out that just like you get baryons in QCD, these are harder to describe in the language, but we still expect something similar from a technicolor theory. And this theory has an exact conserved technique baryon number. And that at this point, there's no mixing between the technique quarks and the standard model quarks, which means that any baryons under technicolor composed of these technique quarks are going to be stable. And these stable things, can be a problem for cosmology. So they're going to be new heavy states with very little interaction to anything light, and this can be an issue. And fourth, this seemed like the point. So the nice thing about technicolor is you don't have a fundamental Higgs field. But the unfortunate thing about technicolor is you don't have a Higgs field, and that we've seen a Higgs field. And it couples like a standard model Higgs. Now, I have a question mark here. This should be a question mark. And the question mark means that, in principle, there could be bound states in the theory, bound states of technique quarks. And some of these bound states can be scalars. And if that scalar, if some of those scalars are not too heavy, they can potentially look like the Higgs. So it's not completely impossible that maybe one of these technique quark bound states, one of these scalar bound states that we don't necessarily know how to describe in a clear way, could be identified with the standard model Higgs. But at the very least, there's no obvious candidate, and we don't know how to compute it. Yes?
So would the bound state be some of the Nyman-Goldstone bosons which have
been eaten? No, generically, it'll just be some other bound state that's not captured in this treatment of the light Nyman-Goldstone boson degrees of freedom. So just like in QCD, there are lots of hadronic excitations that are not captured in our pion theory. The pion theory is just an attempt to identify the light states. And it is true that in QCD, the other states tend to be a bit heavier than the pions. So in any case, we have these four problems. And what ends up happening is this very beautiful and simple technicolor structure gets very messy when you start to try to address these. So I don't want to spend, because it ends up being very messy, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but I want to give you an idea of how it goes. So for 1, 2, and 3, they can be addressed by something called extended technicolor. So E stands for extended. And the idea here is that you have an even larger gauge group, ETC, of which the technicolor gauge group and the standard model gauge groups are subgroups. So you have some even bigger structure. And presumably, at some lambda ETC scale, you have some spontaneous breaking, presumably of a similar structure to this, of GETC to GTC cross G standard model. So G standard model is just 3, 2, 1. So there's some large scale, and people have written down specific theories for this, but the generic result you get from this is a set of interaction Lagrangians that mix standard model fields and technicolor fields with each other. And the form of these fields, in terms of the effective theory between ETC and lambda TC, so here's lambda ETC, here's lambda TC. You can write down an effective theory in this intermediate region. So above here, you have the full ETC. Here you have technicolor cross standard model. And here you just have standard model with electric symmetry breaking. So the terms you get are generically of the following form. So the generic form of the terms you get can be classified in four classes. So this is so these Qs correspond to technicolor objects. So this is a TC TC. This is a TC standard model fermion interaction, and this is standard model interaction. So this term is going to give. This term is going to give new interactions between the techni quarks. And you can show that when you go through the technicolor condensate, this generates masses for the would-be techni pions. If I look at this operator also when I go through the technicolor the technicolor transition, this thing is going to look like lambda TC cubed. So this thing is going to give me something that looks like my effective Lagrangian, lambda TC cubed over lambda ETC squared times F bar F. And this is good. This gives us fermion masses. The problem with this, though, is that our lambda TC is fixed by electric symmetry breaking to be on the order of a few hundred GeV. And it can be challenging to get all of the it can be challenging to get all of the quark masses right. So for one thing, if you want to get a top quark mass, lambda TC has to be about the same as lambda ETC. So chances are that's not going to work in this effective field theory picture. But it turns out that even for the lighter quarks, There could be an issue here, and I'll come back to that in a second. And finally, this is a new standard model for fermion operator suppressed by lambda ETC. And in general, this fermion or standard model operator is going to induce new effects. And one of the possible new effects is flavor mixing. So for example, I could have new these standard model fermions don't have to be the same flavor. And in general, in these ETC theories, they aren't. And these new operators can have all kinds of observable effects within the standard model. And one of those is it can be a new source of flavor mixing. And the upshot of this new flavor mixing is, the new flavor mixing is very constrained. And it forces lambda ETC to be larger than, at least in the worst case scenario, something like 10 to the 6 GeV. So for this kind of operator not to be dangerous in terms of flavor mixing, you need a very large lambda ETC scale to suppress it. But now if I go back to this, it's a problem for my fermion masses. And the standard model fermion masses being too small is still a problem even for the strange and charm quarks, which are not especially heavy. So the top quark we've already written off. In general, the third generation we've written off. But even the first and second generation start to become a problem once you put in these flavor bounds. Now, there's also a way to fix this. So as I said, the nice technicolor story becomes complicated. And the way to fix this effect is is so-called walking technicolor. So walking technicolor comes about because walking technicolor can come about if there are large renormalization group effects that are related to the strong dynamics of technicolor, and that affect these operators, this operator and this operator, more than this operator. So the idea in walking technicolor is that you have some very large ETC scale, but as you run down from ETC to lambda ETC to lambda TC, these strong renormalization effects give you big enhancements of this operator and this operator relative to this operator. And this is exactly what we want. This is going to push out the standard model masses. It's going to effectively reduce the relative effect of the bad standard model new operators. And it's also going to make the technipions heavier. And the nicest way to get this to work is to have the technicolor group in this intermediate range be approximately conformal. And what I mean by that is that in this range, the gauge coupling for lambda technicolor is relatively large, but its running is flat. And if the running is flat, you can stay at a large coupling for a long time. Whereas what happens in QCD, the running isn't flat, and you go very quickly from a small coupling up to a big coupling. But if the running of your coupling is flat, you can stay at a big coupling for a long time, and that means that you can, in some sense, build up and build up and build up these big renormalization group effects by keeping the coupling big. And that's how walking technicolor can make this piece and this piece big compared to this. And in principle, this kind of thing can work as well. The problem is that once the coupling for technicolor becomes big, we don't really have control over technicolor in that regime anyhow. So this idea of walking technicolor, it's hard to write down explicit theories. We're actually going to come back and look at realizations of walking technicolor within the context of extra dimensions. So this sounds a little bit funny, but it's going to turn out that in a limit where this gauge theory picture is relatively strongly coupled, we're going to be able to match this onto an extra dimensional theory through something called holography, or at least a hand wavy version of it. But in any case, I'm basically done with technicolor. I'll say a few more comments tomorrow and then move on to extra dimensions, and also connect back later on to this walking technicolor idea. I think you've also done, I think it's in your homework, you'll also see how big renormalization group effects can build up if the coupling is approximately constant. But in any case, technicolor is a very nice idea. It's hard to make work in practice. But there might still be a realization in terms of extra dimensional theories where we can compute things more reliably. So I'll finish up here. What I said about extra dimensions probably sounds very cryptic now, but I'll try to flesh it out later on.